The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
Live from the WGBB studios in Merrick, New York, this is Sports Talk New York.
From the crossroads of Merrick Avenue and Sunrise Highway in beautiful Merrick, Long Island, this is Sports Talk New York on WGBB 95.9 FM, 1240 AM. I'm your host, Mike Guidone, joined as always by the man we call Cappy, Chris Caputo. 516-623-1240 is our number if you'd like to give a call tonight, 516-623-1240. Got an action-packed program. Going to talk a little U.S. Open tennis, which was a huge story here in the New York area. Just finished up tonight. We'll have Jamie Loeb, our USTA, WTA player and correspondent, to kind of break everything down for us. We'll talk a little New York Jets football with John Santamaria. And finally, we'll speak to Eric Sherman, who wrote a book with former Mets manager Davey Johnson, who unfortunately passed away over the weekend. Looking forward to speaking to him about his time with Davey. But before we get to any of that, let's welcome Chris Caputo. Cap, how you doing?
Great, Mike. Good to be back in the studio with you. Fun-filled night of talking. You know, we always put something good together.
Yeah.
You know, even when things don't match up, we find a way to get through. So phone lines tonight, 516-623-1240, in case you want to call in. We're going to get to that tennis in a couple of minutes. And, you know, it was nice to see for over 2 weeks, you know, that area get a good amount of fans in there, get some good tennis.
Oh, yeah.
Hopefully people like it. I know it becomes packed, especially when you got Mets games going on at the same time. There's really nowhere to stay, nowhere to drive around that area. But, you know, if you take mass transit, you have a way of getting in and out.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, what the Open did, they always sell the grounds passes. They started a little earlier. We talked about that a couple of weeks ago. But love to get Jamie's thoughts on that as well as a current touring player and someone who has played at the Open previously. You know, we'll talk a little bit on the Mets. They just seem to, when they looks like they can pull away, they drop a couple of tough ones. They're four up in the wild card, but as we were talking before we came on the air, tough schedule coming up. You know, this is no gimme going into, you know, the end of September.
I don't like looking at a lot of these things, but I do. Here's what I would rather, Mike. Mets win and then you don't scoreboard watch. You can look at it later if you right. want. But, like, when the Mets lose, all everybody wants to do is, did the Giants lose today?
Yeah.
Did the Reds lose today? Did the Braves lose today? Did the Phillies lose today? And it's just annoying. Like, just take care of business.
Right.
And it's nice to win that Friday night game and say, okay, now we've won with, you know, mm-hmm. whoever pitches that night. But now you're just desperate to try and take two out of three. You lose two. Now you have to go into Philly and play four.
Yeah.
And you got the Rangers coming in. Eventually, you got to play a more, you know, they have the hardest schedule moving forward. But I just hate it. It says they have a 93.3% chance of making the playoffs. You know what? It's 19 games to go and and only a four-game lead.
Yes.
If they lose 12 out of 19 games, you know, there's a chance that somebody's going to catch them.
Absolutely.
And hopefully you hold the tiebreaker over them if it happens to be a tie.
Well, you know, we've seen this happen before in September, and we hate to bring it up, but, you know, that,
it just feels like it's happening for me. Most people say, oh, we're good. Feels like it's happening. The other part is, Mike, even if they do make it in a three-game series,
yeah, they're not going
who's pitching for them? Exactly. Who's hitting for them?
Yeah, it's when you have three rookies who are really topping your rotation going into September here. You know, Sproat looked great today. You know, good for him.
No hits for five innings.
Yeah, Jonah Tong, you know, he got bounced around a little bit last night, but you expect that. You know, gave up a couple of long balls.
Yes.
But he gutted it out. You know, good to see those guys, but you hope that you weren't relying on that at this point in the season. But
I think you're going to have to, and think at some point you might even have to start to come up with tandems
yes.
of guys that are going to be able to go 3 to 4 innings and another guy that's going to be able to go 4 to 5 innings to get you through 8 and then get you to the closer. Because, listen, it was very stressful the other night, but it was kind of fun to watch Edwin Diaz. I mean, that was a spectacle to watch the cleats come off, to get the bases loaded, and for him to cover first on a play where last year he didn't. Mike, that was exciting.
Yeah, it was. And you thought, you know what, here's the, not the turning point, but here's something where, all right, we're going to shut the door, we're going to run away with this, and then boom, two losses in a row. But they're making it interesting. You know, Yanks on the other side, they not that they're hot, but they are kind of getting a little separation as well.
Well, also, they're two games behind the Blue Jays now.
Right, yeah.
So now they have a shot of winning the division and, you know, a game and a half on the Red Sox. So, yeah, it should be interesting. I would think the Yankees at this point are close to 100% for making the playoffs. So,
absolutely. So we're going to we'll talk a little bit more about that later on. As we mentioned, Jets open up with a loss today, but a tight one. Giants, you know, we can spend a few minutes if we have some time on that. Unfortunately, they went down. D looked good. Offense not so great. And as we mentioned, we'll talk the life and times of Davey Johnson later on. But we're lucky right now and happy to be joined by our tennis insider, member of the WTA Tour, ITF Tour, Jamie Loeb. Jamie, welcome to the program. Great to have you back on.
Thank you. Thanks for having me back.
Oh, absolutely. You know, great tournament as always, but you and I had kind of, we traded some messages off air about, you know, the tournament in general, and both Chris and I have some questions, being that, you know, obviously you spend a lot of time on the grounds, you've played there, there's going to be some different changes going on, and also, you know, a couple things within the tournament itself. I'm very curious to get your thoughts on mixed doubles and some things with that, but let's start off with, you know, really, you know, just a solid tournament for the American ladies, Irina Sabalenka just too tough over Anisimov yesterday, 6-3, 7-6. Although it was a pretty tight match. Can we get your thoughts on that? And you know, is Sabalenka just at this point heads and shoulders above everybody else, or is it just, you know, a little bit here and there?
Yeah, you know, Sabalenka, she has been playing so fearless. Especially, I watched the entire match when she played Jessica Gould in the semis, and honestly, Jessie played some of her best tennis,
yes,
and Sabalenka still was able to out-hit her and just, like, come away with it. You know, it was incredible. Both women hit the ball so hard. Same with Anisimova. I think with Anisimova, you know, just a little bit of nerves, her serve let her down. That was really crucial. So, you know, I just think that her overall athleticism and her ability now to incorporate some variety, you saw some drop shots and her actually looking to come to net. And I think even her defending has really improved too. She's not just hitting straight up. She's able to move well, get herself from defense straight into offense and, you know, use those drop shots too to kind of throw her opponents off balance. So I feel like she's made a lot of improvements in her game, but just she's swinging as hard as she can on every ball. Like,
yeah,
she's not slowing down and they're all going in, and it's just so fast and penetrating. It's just really hard to counter that.
Yeah, it's a shame that the, you know, Pegula match wasn't really the final, because that was just a nip and tuck. And I think that's the kind of match, you know, back in the past, that Sabalenka, when she loses the first set, might kind of crumble. But she, like you said, she's hitting fearlessly, comes right back and takes it, and then goes to another final. So very entertaining stuff.
Yeah, and also too, I was paying attention closely to her body language, and she resets so well after each point. Sometimes it's even like a little smile when she lost the point and her opponent either hit too good of a shot,
yeah,
or, you know, she did the right thing and lost the point. But just seeing how she bounces back after every point is incredible. And like you said, I think in the past she might have some lapses mentally,
yeah,
but now it seems she's able to really reset, and you can see those resets. You can just see her breathing and taking her time. I feel like she doesn't rush in between points as much as maybe she has in the past. So I think, like, that's just been a huge advantage for her, just being able to go to the next point and, you know, not really hesitate or question or doubt what she just did.
Sure.
Jamie, it seemed, you know, the semifinal match, Anisimova was up against Naomi Osaka, who both of them had stepped away from tennis for mental health issues. Do you think that their break and kind of bringing women's tennis mental health issues into light is kind of a way that maybe got both of them back into the game, by both of them addressing their struggles and their anxieties and being able to make it back to the top 10 again?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there's definitely something to be said, you know, just taking care of yourself and just giving yourself the proper time to reset and, you know, just step away gives you some perspective as well. And just to slow down to the tour is so demanding as is, and to be able to just, whether it's 6 months, a year, 2 years, to just kind of like reset and also reset your body a little bit goes a long way. I mean, I'm actually taking a bit of a break right now.
Yes.
And, you know, I definitely miss competing, but I just know I'm not in the space to be doing that right now. So it's also been, it's also just been nice to be able to spend more time with family and even, you know, explore other things that maybe you didn't have the chance to do while you're on tour, because it's very demanding once you're on tour, whether you're playing the ITF circuit or WTAs or Grand Slams. Like, you're, it's all about you and the proper training, and just you have to be so disciplined and mentally and physically engaged every single day that it catches up to you.
Sure.
Over time. And so I think it's really great to see these players being able to recognize that and take the time that they need to come back even stronger, and it's proven to work.
You know, years ago, the term burnout used to come up, and it, unfortunately, at that point, it was almost like a dirty word. Like, people say, oh, that, you know, the players are so burnt out. And but, you know, as you kind of pointed out, that's real. I mean, you've been playing tennis. I mean, really, how long have you been playing tennis where it's 7 days a week for you? Since what age?
Well, so I'm 30 now. I started playing tennis when I was 3 years old, but I mean, probably in my teenage years, I would say.
Since you were a young adult, you know, just in that itself, and then becoming a professional, it's got to be just so taxing, as you said. And then when you're talking about whatever level it is, whether it's ITF or WTA, we know, you know, you lost your dad, and we certainly want to send our thoughts to you. And it, absolutely. And I'm sure, you know, that along with taking a break and just spending more time, hopefully that will be something, like you said, you're doing some different things now. And if you decide to, you know, come back, your body will be a little bit stronger. Hopefully, you know, your mind you can focus in. But I think it's something, as Chris was alluding to, that it's just it's so important in life, but also professional athletes now, and especially on the tennis side, can take a little break and really not have it ruin their career.
Yeah, and, you know, like for me right now in this period of time, I mean, maybe not as fortunate as some of the top players where I can just, you know, kind of chill out and do what I want. But, you know, I've been doing some coaching, make some money, because that's another thing, too, that, like, adds to the stress of the sport, which people, you know, may not see at the top level, but at the lower levels, it's hard. So also finding stability in that, which has actually been pretty nice, because us tennis players are not used to having that financial stability.
Yes.
So knowing what you're going to be making each day or each week has been actually nice. And it's crazy. That's like a shocker, where most people, and maybe most people that are listening are like, well, I have a normal job with fixed income. Like, that should be a normal thing, but it's not. So, yeah, like, that's provided other opportunities. And, you know, for me, just to even explore other things outside of just competing, has been cool to see, because you just don't have this time when you're on tour and you feel like you have to go to the next tournament and you have to, you know, do all the little things. And to be able to slow down and kind of pick and choose what you want to do and also give your body some time to heal a little bit is really important, and something that we don't get enough on tour.
Yeah, there's not a real true off season for you guys. And I think that's something that, you know, of course, the more tournaments that you can enter and be able to play, and, you know, financially and with your ranking, that's great. But as you mentioned, it's different, you know, in the life of a professional athlete. There's all sorts of things that come along with it that people don't get. So I wanted to ask you, and Chris will follow up with me as well, your time at the Open this year, obviously, spent a little differently, kind of more being around the grounds, looking at it from a little different perspective. You've obviously played the tournament a couple of times. What were your thoughts just on the overall feeling of the tournament? And the second question would be, have you spoken to anybody about what their thoughts were with the new mixed doubles scenario? I know we had Irina Falcone on a couple weeks ago, and she was saying that there were very mixed reactions. You know, it was kind of good for the tournament and got a lot of interest, but for the players who were double specialists, it was really a tough time. So that's a two-parter, so take that any way that you feel.
Yeah, the first part, definitely it was weird just being on the grounds as a spectator than playing. I was actually thinking about when the last time I did that, and honestly, I think that was before college, and when I was like a teenager, because I've been playing in the Open for many years, from qualifying to main draw, doubles, mixed doubles, so it was definitely different. And it was definitely a different vibe at the Open. I mean, I've talked to some people about it too, and it just feels like it's not as accessible for the average tennis fan or tennis family anymore. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's, on the pro side, you know, or like, it's just, it's good that it's creating attention and people are coming and it's generating revenue and, you know, hopefully that money goes to, you know, resources for USTA. But on the other side, there's just so many people that are there just to take a photo and just say that they went to the US Open. Yes. It's become just an event.
Right.
Instead of something where, you know, you, like years ago too, you know, you just get these passionate tennis fans that's just become so expensive.
Yeah.
And I heard that tickets were hard to come by and super expensive to get grounds passes, and that's kind of sad. That's just sad, because the average tennis fan and family, like, that's something they do and, you know, appreciate the sport. I just feel like it's turned into something completely different. I know it's all about making money, and that's, I guess, the pro side of it, but the con is just it's not leaving a good taste in the tennis world or the tennis fans that, you know, love this sport and want to be there. It's becoming more of an elite event. Even the renovations, it's, you know, more suites and more like upscale dining and that.
Yeah.
And it just seems more exclusive. And it's just attracting a different crowd.
Yeah.
So that part I wasn't a huge fan of, and just, yeah, the prices are outrageous.
Oh,
and it's like,
it's,
I don't
only
know,
gonna
you,
get worse.
You can't even, yeah, it only gets worse. I mean, you're going to spend at least, like, at the minimum, like $25 on a meal there, let alone, you know, whatever, parking and tickets, and a water is at least $7. So it's just, it's crazy. So that part, you know, it doesn't leave a great taste in my mouth. And then, yeah, the other part, you know, I've spoken to a variety of players, too, about the mixed doubles. Look, I think what they did was great. I think it brought a lot of people in. They got to see some of the top singles players up close and, you know, get to have that taste before the main draw started. Brought a lot of people into qualifying, which was great. More eyes on tennis, that was great. It was crowded though. It was like jam packed the ground. So that part, I was like, oh my God, there's so many more people here.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So, but anyways, I think that could be a separate event. I think they can keep this new format of mixed doubles separate than the actual mixed doubles tournament, because I don't know, like, I don't care what you say, but a set to four is an exhibition.
Yeah.
And I'm going to be upfront about it.
No, and I appreciate that.
Yeah, like a set to four,
that's not
is an exhibition. That's not a grand slam. I'm really happy, you know, like, I'm really happy that people enjoy the tennis and they love seeing it, but they can make that a separate event and still get that crowd.
Right.
While keeping a regular mixed doubles tournament. And if those players want to play both events, they can do that. But mm-hmm. I just don't think it should replace the actual mixed doubles event, which doubles players, that's their opportunity to you know, make income, and that's their specialty. So,
right.
Yeah, I wish next year that they would do both events.
What a great opportunity it would be, right, to have that exhibition, make that an exhibition, and make it something like a fundraiser for tennis cares or, you know, tennis against cancer, anything to get everyone involved, still make it, you know, on TV, get people to come early. But then, yeah, absolutely, have a Grand Slam real tournament where you're playing four games. I'm not a big social media guy, but I commented on a lot of posts with different things, and I got crucified by some people who were like, oh, you know, you just don't get it, and then the other thing was like, yeah, absolutely. I that's why I was dying to ask you, because I'm sure from a player's standpoint, you know, who grinds it out, it's gotta be a little upsetting.
Yeah, for sure. I think there's a world where they can do both events, yeah. But it just doesn't
a Grand Slam. Sorry.
Yeah, it also just doesn't really set a great standard too for, you know, the people that are playing doubles and you know, giving that, like, taking away that opportunity. And right now, the other slams have a regular mixed doubles event, so
yeah, it's,
I don't know why.
It's just, it's such a New York American thing to do, I think, just to, you know, try something that, you know, we just think is our right to do it, to change it to four games. It's just, you know, I love being an American. I love American tennis, but you'd never see that in London or Australia. I mean, I'm sorry, I just can't, or France for Pete's sake.
Yeah, there's no way.
Again, we're talking Jamie Loeb. You know, I it's interesting to see some of the changes that are made. Like, when you have a match with Isner where it goes like 71-69, obviously maybe you need to make some changes because the what did it last, like 3 days or something like that? But, you know, sometimes making drastic changes on the fly is no good. I did want to ask a little bit about the men. When we had Irina Falcone-Hartman on a couple weeks ago, I gave her the option of Sinner, Alcaraz, Djokovic to win the whole thing, or you can have everybody else in the field. And she said it's going to be a Sinner-Alcaraz final. And it's amazing how with 128 people still left in the field, these two are, I mean, I don't know how much of it you watched, but these two are just head and shoulders above everyone else. Can you, like, take in how good these professionals are?
Yeah, and I have been watching more of their matches, actually, more closely, this US Open too, and it's crazy just how they're able to just defend and then get back and change that into being aggressive the next shot right away. It's like they're all the way stretched out in the corner, and then all of a sudden Alcaraz is like on the baseline ready to take, you know, the ball early, and I'm like, how did you even get there?
Mm-hmm.
And especially against Sinner today, I mean, his court positioning was insane. Like, he was forcing Sinner to come up with shots because he was pressing him and trying to move forward
side
and
side.
just taking time away. And I'm like, how do you take time away from a ball that's coming insanely fast, insanely heavy and deep? And just both of them are so precise and accurate. And it's just crazy. Like, the level is just so high. And similar to the women's side, like, just both sides, everyone's just hitting the ball so fast, but then they're in position for the next ball right away. And it just doesn't seem, it just takes a lot for these guys to be put out of position. And today's the first time, though, I saw Sinner actually, like, physically look tired, and Alcaraz was just, like, another level on the physical side, which is just crazy to believe. I don't know what these guys are doing, but it's really impressive.
Yeah, Chris and I were talking before we came on about the Sinner. He just didn't look right. I mean, it's still amazing that he can go this far and play tremendous and, you know, drop one set going into the final. But yeah, there was just a little difference. But all kudos, you know, to Alcaraz, because he's just a beast, and to get in that kind of shape and not even break a sweat, it looked like, in four sets is crazy.
And to do that for the entire tournament as well is so impressive. It's not just one match. It's just, like, match after match, and being able to,
at
in
the
a way,
highest
raise
level.
Your level.
Yeah.
It's Very impressive.
Never face break points. It's unbelievable.
It's craziness. So, Jamie, one last thing we wanted to ask you was a little bit more about the, you know, the physical plant of the U.S. Open and Nash Stadium. A couple of years ago, I was very lucky. I got to take a tour of Roland Garros, and it was in the wintertime, and going into the different stadiums, and just, you know, amazing places, great places to watch tennis. Then you go to Ash, and you know, nothing, no knock against Ash, but the higher deck is higher than Citi Field to watch a baseball. It's a really whole different feel. And I know that they're making some changes, and I believe you had posted something about, you know, trying to find the scoreboard even while you were there. Do you think that they can do something to make it both, you know, like you had mentioned, where you can have these suites and whatever else, but it's still a tennis stadium? Do you think that can be done?
Look, I'm no engineer, but hopefully. But, you know, kind of to what you were alluding to, I just felt, you know, they have two kind of like jumbotrons showing the match plus the game score,
right,
but it doesn't show the set score, yeah, or like, you know, so like 40-30, but it doesn't say like, is it like 3-1, 3-all? It doesn't show the sets. And the set is only on the side of the stadium. Like, you have to look for it.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think that's not great for not only a non-tennis fan, but just tennis fans in general that are just also like, want to know what the actual score is.
Right.
And I also think the screens, compared to the size of the stadium, the screens seem pretty small,
mm-hmm,
compared to the rest of the stadium. The stadium, I mean, it's massive. And I was a little bit higher up a couple of days ago watching Novak and Alcaraz, and then a couple of weeks ago watching the mixed doubles, I was like lower. So I kind of got a feel for both views, and definitely it just seems so far away when you're higher up and can't really gauge,
yes,
to the ball as well. It just is a lot different. But I don't know what exactly they're going to do or how they're going to do it. I know they're going to add some more, I think, either like court level suites or just some more suites in general.
Mm-hmm.
But definitely like the scoreboard and the screens, I feel they can also make changes to that just so people that are lost can at least understand what's
right,
going on.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to show my age here real quick. In the summer of 1987, as I was graduating high school, I snuck into the U.S. Open through the kitchen when there were no grounds passes, and I got to sit about five rows up on Louis Armstrong Stadium when there were no roofs, and it was unbelievable. Now I would get arrested. I would probably, my picture would be everywhere. So as you were saying before about the average fan, it's a tough one, and I'm so glad that you were able to give us the perspective of being down low and up top and as a player, just seeing everything. So to the player part of it, what's on your agenda? Do you have anything planned? Are you looking to take the rest of the season off? You know, what's ahead for you on the playing front?
Yeah, you know, right now I'm planning on taking the rest of the year off, just kind of give myself some time and spend some time with my family and do, you know, a little bit of coaching on the side.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, like I've been pretty active, though, working out and, you know, hitting, but not necessarily for me, more for others. But
right,
hoping to be back on tour early next year and just kind of take care of the mind and body the rest of this year.
Well, Jamie, we can't thank you enough. We're really rooting for you. It's so wonderful to always have you on and get your perspective as a player and as a coach. And I'm sure you're going to be, you know, continuing with that. You're a New Yorker. Just a great perspective on everything. Enjoy the time off. Spend it with your family and please join us again if that allows in your schedule.
Of course. I love coming on here with you guys.
All
I appreciate
right,
it.
Jamie Loeb, New York State champion, NCAA champion, WTA player, and just a great all-around person. All the best, and we'll talk soon.
Appreciate it.
Absolutely. So we're going to take a little break, and then we're going to come back. We're going to talk to John Santa Maria about the Jet game today, and then we'll be following it up with Eric Sherman, author on his book with David Johnson.
listening to Sports Talk New York. Tune in every Sunday night at 8 p.m. on Long Island's WGBB. Broadcasting on 95.9 FM and 1240 AM. Or listen live online at WGBBRadio.com. Stay connected to Sports Talk New York on WGBB by following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at WGBB Sports Talk. You're listening to Sports Talk New York on Long Island's WGBB. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to the second half hour of Sports Talk New York here on WGBB 95.9, 1240 AM. 516-623-1240 is our number if you'd like to call in, talk a little Jets right now. We're going to bring in our Jets insider, and that is Mr. John Santamaria. Tough one out there at the stadium today, but a lot to build on, John. And, you know, nice to see the Jets score. I wish it was a different quarterback on the other side, but, that's another story for another time when we have some more. But welcome in, and what were your thoughts on today's game?
All right, so there was a lot going on.
Yes.
So let's start with the offense, because that has been the problem for the Jets for a long time. And I said this when Aaron Glenn came in. What's one of the first things he did? He got rid of Aaron Rodgers. They said, we don't want you here. And one of the comments he said post-game, we'll get into a lot of other things with him, but he said there's people in that room who felt like can't play anymore. I don't think that was ever the case.
No.
I think they felt this is not the quarterback we want under our regime.
Right.
And I totally agree with that. And I had said, all right, if he chooses to go somewhere else or stay with Rodgers for another year, I think they'll make it work because it's going to be on their terms, not going to be on Aaron's terms. So let's start with that. So I like the emphasis of the running game. You felt like you were watching the Lions, because that's what they did so well with Ben Johnson and Tanner Engstrom, who was the offensive coordinator for the Jets. The only thing that's a little bit different, and we'll just have to get used to, both of those linebacks, Gibbs and Montgomery, the catch out of the backfield, we haven't really seen that much of that from Braylon Allen. It's more of like your power play back, but Breece Hall could also play back, and he was excellent today. So I think that was a big positive that they have not had.
Yeah, and you got 107 yards out of Breece Hall, trying to run the ball a little much. Time of possession was good. They had the ball for 34 minutes, more than half the game. I think what I was hoping to see with Aaron Glenn bringing in officials to their practices to make it more real was less of, kind of the fallacies. And I still saw 7 penalties for 74 yards, a fumbled kickoff. Calling a timeout on a 2-point conversion. A lot of that stuff that was, to me, disciplinary seems to still be there, John.
A little bit. I didn't agree. Let's go back to the 2-point conversion from the first half when the penalty was called against Pittsburgh and they went to the 1-yard line. I thought that early in the game you just kick it. And then maybe they wouldn't have been in this situation. They would have been in late, having to go down the field hoping for a win while trying, because if it was tied 34-all and they had the ball in their hands and Pittsburgh tied the game on that field goal, if all was magically the way it possibly should have been, you're calling a whole different game, a whole different set of plays on that last drive. In the worst case scenario is you play and go to overtime.
Yeah, and let's be honest, John. If they come down,
I think that's something he could clean up, Aaron Glenn.
Yeah,
I think that's something on him. He'll take the blame for that. I think he could clean that up. I think he was just trying. I think he was trying something.
Sure. And if they come down and kick a field goal and win the game, what do you think everybody's talking about? How prolific the offense seemed. We didn't expect the Jets to put up 30-something points. I think the over/under that people were talking about were 40 for the game, and that was met by halftime. So I think the offense did a pretty good job, but I think where some of the problem were was the secondary got picked on a little bit today.
Yeah, so that was the one area of concern I had, and personally I feel like that'll get cleaned up. That's also, I think, very tough with a new coaching staff. And I was watching the Lions play the Packers shortly after, and I think, well, the Jets have an entirely new coaching staff.
Mm-hmm.
The Lions do too, because of everybody they lost between the Jets, the Bears, and a couple other teams around the league. So there's going to be some, the point is there's going to be some growing pains. And luckily with Glenn, yeah, he's not calling defense like some of the past head coaches here has. He's got a very good defensive coordinator in Steve Wilkes, so I think they will clean up. But the one thing that they did mention during the game, and I've never coached football, but knowing a lot of this, J.J. Watt mentioned this during the game, that they said the safeties and the corners, so Sauce Gardner had mentioned the safeties and the corners never had their meetings together until Aaron Glenn walked in the door. I found that interesting when they were discussing that. You would think the whole defensive back room would be doing all their meetings there, not safeties and corners separately. So I think that's a good thing to get those little things we're talking about cleaned up.
So, John, I wanted to ask you, I thought they did a great job with Justin Fields today. He was 16 of 22, 218, a touchdown. I thought they put him in spots to make solid decisions. I thought he ran the ball when it was necessary. I think that's exactly what you want out of him. And that's a really great sign, you know, going into the rest of the season, coming off the first game. When you literally, in this game, it was a trade of quarterbacks. Last year, you know, Justin was at least at the beginning of the season, was taking care of the Steelers and Rodgers. So what'd you see out of Fields, and are you as enthused as I am about him?
Yeah, absolutely, and I said that the day they signed him. I think Justin Fields just needs to be given a chance to unleash himself and show everybody what he could do. He was not coached well in Chicago. Pittsburgh did not treat him well. He should have never been benched last year. And realistically, he probably should still be the quarterback of the Steelers, but that's a whole other situation. They wanted to go all in and go the real veteran route. And despite what happened on that last play, that ended the game on fourth down, where Gal Wilson dropped the ball on the, not really dropped the ball on the hard hit by Ramsey, which I thought a penalty possibly could have been called there, but okay. Fields played a great game. He showed a lot of his abilities. He showed a lot of his skill sets. There's a lot of good film.
So
good and bad going into practice this week.
Yeah, and listen, this was a game we didn't know what we were going to get, and seven lead changes or something like that. What are your overall feelings now moving forward as the season goes on? Do you think you, yourself, and all the Jet fans have a more positive feeling, or do you think there is a lot more people that are thinking this is going to be the same old Jets?
That's a very good question. And I think when you go in during the week, I think the focus, like what's going to be on, like if you're asking what's going to be on the cover of the paper tomorrow, I think it'll be, even though a loss, positive vibes with the Jets, because the focus is going to be on the problems with the other team in town that I think are a much bigger issue. I feel like watching them today, I feel like they have direction. They're going somewhere. They
sure
have a plan. They have not had a plan. I don't think there was a plan when Rodgers came in here. I don't think there was a full plan when Robert Sala was hired as the head coach. I don't even know if there was a great plan when Adam Gase was brought in here as the head coach. I feel like both of these guys, Aaron Glenn and the general manager, Darren Moody, came in here. This is what we want to do, and this is how we're going to do it. There's going to be some growing pains. We're aware of that, but we're not going to let the problems continue. I felt last year with the Jets, Robert Sala had them, and the year before, a couple years before that, very undisciplined. So I think they'll go into practice this week. They will not let those things happen. As you already said, you're going to fumble kickoffs, you're not playing. You're going to make stupid penalties, you're not playing. So he is, in some ways, kind of like what you would do in high school and college. And somebody who's around a lot of high school athletes, you'll hear a lot of coaches saying, well, if you're going to make little dumb mistakes like this, or in some ways, we as teachers know this, you're going to fail and you're ineligible to play for the school and you're not playing, we're not going to make you an exception to you because you have this contract. You're not going to play. And I like that mindset from him. He wants to win more than ever. Glenn wore that uniform. And I think it means something to him if he could get it turned around here.
Absolutely. When you have carte blanche to run the team the way you want, and you have that that background, you know, I think that's a it's a real recipe for success, or at least, you know, a turnaround and get things going. John, thanks so much for coming on. We look forward. We'll talk to you in 2 weeks, hopefully with a win under their belt and heading into a little bit deeper in the season. But great analysis, as always. We thank you, and go Jets.
Yes, and one last thing with the Jets. If Woody Johnson stays away like James Dolan stayed away and let the Knicks do what they need to do, this is going to get turned around before you know it.
Absolutely.
All right. Let's go Mets, too.
Yes, absolutely. John Santamaria, thanks.
Cross, guys.
Absolutely. Thanks so much. We'll talk to you in a couple of weeks. Great stuff. But now we're gonna switch gears here a little bit. Again, the number's 516-623-1240 on
Mike,
WGBB.
I'm going to tell you, this hit me kind of hard.
Yeah, me as well.
There's a couple of guys that when they're not here anymore, it hits you. And you know, I think of him and Gary Carter together at this point. But go ahead, take it away.
Absolutely. No, I was lucky enough to meet David Johnson once, and he couldn't have been nicer. And now we're lucky enough to be joined by Eric Sherman, who wrote the book My Wild Ride in Baseball and Beyond with David Johnson. Eric, welcome to the program, and thanks so much for giving us a few minutes tonight.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure. Great to be here.
So you wrote a book with Davey. Obviously, you got to know him pretty well. What were your thoughts, you know, when you heard that he had passed, and were you aware that things were kind of progressing the way they were at that time?
Yeah, you know, I got a call from his wife Susan at 8 a.m. yesterday morning, and when her number popped up on my phone, I sensed what it was, and you know, I had seen Davey. I spent a few days at his house, just catching up. We were catching up back in late February. He was living down in Sarasota, and you know, the thing of it is, when you write a book with someone about their life story, you know, you become their best friend, their priest, their therapist, all rolled into one, and a bond develops. And that's what developed for Davey and I. I had written a book before I worked with Davey entitled Kings of Queens, Life Beyond Baseball with the 86 Mets. And Davey wrote the foreword to that book. Mm-hmm. And he loved the book so much that he's like, you're my guy to write my memoir. And so we worked together. And, you know, I'm now working on my 10th book on baseball, and the book with Davey by far was the most work I ever put into a book because of his life both on and off the field was just, I mean, there's just so many stories. I mean, 50 years in the game. And so we spent a lot of time together, and a friendship developed. And it's definitely hitting me hard like everybody else, even though I knew that he had been pretty sick for a while.
Eric, can you just let us know how you got introduced to Davey and how the book kind of came about?
Yeah, well, really, I met him for the most part when I was writing Kings of Queens, and we needed someone to write the foreword, and I thought, well, who better than Davey Johnson? He was the manager of the team. He was, I mean, he really, his brashness and his gravitas really exemplified that 86 Mets team, and he wrote a great forward. He really did, and he take, you know, his face still, like even when I saw him in February and we were talking about the 86 Mets, even though he wasn't well, you know, his face just lit up, and we actually did a podcast together. I have a podcast, Eric Sherman Baseball, and that was, you know, during the podcast, he talked about the 86 team quite a bit, and right to the very, very end, he loved talking about his Mets days.
So we're talking with Eric Sherman, who wrote a book with Davey Johnson. I'm reading some of the stuff in the book, and, you know, Davey, let's be honest, he was kind of ahead of his time. He was a player with the Orioles who basically went into his manager and said, we got to start taking statistics. We got to start using some of what we call now analytics to break down, you know, other teams. As a player, he wanted to know, you know, which catcher was catching pitchers the most and, you know, how many times people were getting caught stealing and things like that. Like, could, you know, did you get that from him, that that was something early on in his career, that he was going to be a little bit ahead of his time?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he's a really brilliant guy and a mathematician. And he, so the story that you're alluding to, 1969, through a computer, he devised an optimization of the Orioles lineup. And he ran all these different combinations of Orioles players through this computer. And he walked into Earl Weaver's office, the cantankerous Earl Weaver, and said, "Hey, Earl, if you use this lineup," and a part of that was moving Davey up from, I think, sixth to number two in the lineup, "you know, we're going to score 70 more runs next season." And so Earl took the data and promptly threw it in the trash, and that was the end of it. But Davey was really the first one that brought the computer into baseball when he took over the Mets in 1984, and he had a couple of guys that worked for him. And but I'll say this. Davey was adamantly opposed to relying entirely on computer data and on sabermetrics and all that. He said it was a tool. But basically, you know, you're not going to use that all the time. Like you have to feel the clubhouse. You know, like you have to have a sense of where your players are at. So much of baseball is psychological, and you've got to read the room. I mean, if, you know, if someone's in a slump, if someone had a fight with their wife, you know, like you have to know all that stuff. And the thing he did with his pitching, which was interesting, was that, you know, he wasn't afraid to leave a left-hander in there to face a right-hander, you know, especially with relief pitchers, because he felt, well, how are they ever going to build their confidence if I'm pulling them out in the fifth or sixth inning because, you know, the hitter hits opposite of what they throw. He also didn't like a lot of the rule changes, you know, protecting the second baseman, you know, making the bases bigger, what, you know, needless to say, the Manfred Mann rule in extra innings. He couldn't start, you know, he couldn't stand the idea of starting a closer in the first inning. You know, there was a lot that he didn't like about today's game, but he was still a fan, and he still watched the games, and we watched plenty of games together. And I've always said that you've never truly watched a baseball game until you've watched a game with someone like Davey, because he was the smartest baseball man in every room, and he knew it.
Well, and that's, you don't get to the spot that he did without that, you know, gravitas for sure. So I wanted to ask Eric, you know, so many professional managers, coaches, and whatever else, they're very realistic, and they say that, you know, when they're hired, they generally are hired to eventually be fired. And unfortunately, you know, after a number of years and great success with the Mets, Davey was let go in 1990. What was his relationship with the team after that? And was he in touch with the team? Was it something where, you know, over time that kind of softened?
Took a long time.
Yeah.
You know, when he was fired after a slow start in 1990, and he had the sense that Frank Cashin, the general manager, that he really wanted Buddy Harrelson to be the manager. There was just a sense that Harrelson was more hands-on, that Davey, was too much of a player's manager by that point. And so when they got off to the slow start, he was fired, and, you know, what really bothered Davey about it wasn't so much that he was fired, but it was the fact that the team wouldn't allow him to say goodbye to his players.
Yeah.
They were on the road when he got fired, and they had him leave the side of the hotel, and that hurt him deeply. You know, he had some great relationships with the ball club. But I think after 86, things really started to change. He adored Nelson Doubleday as an owner, adored him, because Doubleday, you know, was very generous with those guys. He took care of them, but just let the managers manage. And, you know, there was no hint of like what Steinbrenner was doing.
Right.
But when Doubleday was no longer, a part owner of the Mets, things started to change. And then later on, Cashin, you know, he had, Al Harrison, and McIlvain, as kind of like assistant GM. So mm-hmm. it was like the three-headed monster. And,
yeah.
and, you know, I think if there was ever a guy in baseball that could have been like a Pat Riley where, you know, they were the manager slash head coach and a GM, it would probably be Davey. When Davey took over the club in 84, I mean, he had run the entire farm system. He had managed three different levels
yeah.
and won championships at all three different levels. So he knew what he had, and he knew that organization and how to develop that organization, how to develop a bullpen, how to develop a bench, how to platoon players. And so I think he would have been a great GM, but he loved being in the dugout. And unfortunately, he couldn't do both.
And, Eric, I think he tried to be the GM at times. He said, listen, Frank, I'm only dealing with you. And at the time, I'm losing my train of thought. The other GM that was around went up to the Boston Red Sox.
Gorman.
Yeah, Lou Gorman went up to the Red
yeah.
Sox. So he basically said, Frank, I'm only dealing with you. And he told him, he said, watch this guy, Doc Gooden. I want him to be on my team at the end of spring training. And he eventually got him to agree, and he took the young kids under his belt. And, you know, that's what kind of led these guys, is he fought for them. He went out there. And the second part about that is he brought Frank Howard on his staff, the guy who he replaced as manager. He brought him on as a coach. That's got to be an interesting situation for a manager.
It was. To your first point, though, about Doc, you know, Doc was 19, and Cashin did not want Gooden to see the major leagues in 1984. And I mean, Davey pleaded with him. He said, look, you know, I'll take care of him.
Right.
Don't worry about it. I'll watch over him. He'll be fine. And Doc was the kind of guy, you know, I mean, this was just, really a couple of years, maybe a year and a half, 2 years before he got involved in drugs. You know, he was the first one at the ballpark, the last one to leave. He very supportive parents. You know, the parents were very, very, very visible, which was just the opposite of Daryl Strawberry, who had an abusive father. And Davey had to play more of a father figure for Daryl. But with Doc, he said he'd take care of him, and he did. And Doc went out and won the Rookie of the Year award, and along with other youngsters like Sid Fernandez and Ron Darling, that 84 team, you know, everybody talks about 86 and how much fun 86 was. I think if you're a Mets fan, 84 has got to be there. I mean, I think it's got to be, if not higher than 86, on a par, because
they were so bad for so long.
84 was a lot like 69.
Yes.
Nobody saw it coming.
Absolutely.
Electric. And, you know, they had 7 years in the wilderness. And all of a sudden, you know, I mean, they're in first place for most of the summer over the Cubs. If the Cubs don't trade for Rick Sutcliffe in June from Cleveland, and Sutcliffe, you know, he was in the National League for only 4 months and he wins the Cy Young Award. I mean, Sutcliffe could not lose. And, you know, they don't make that trade. I mean, the Mets, without question, win the division, and who knows what else. I mean, that was an incredibly fun season, 84. Yeah.
Eric, quick question. He is one of three managers to go to the playoffs with four different teams, the Reds, the Orioles, the Nationals, and he also managed overseas. He also managed the USA team. Did he talk any about having like a favorite place or enjoying like that USA time a little bit more than some of the other stuff?
He loved his time with the U.S. team. Loved it. Loved everything about it. Davey was a really patriotic guy. You know, his his father was a veteran, and he was very, very proud to be manager of the U.S. team. In terms of where he enjoyed managing the most, I mean, it was New York. It was New York, I'll say, from 84 through 86. After 86, things really got strange.
Yeah.
And that was after winning a World Series. But he just felt like after winning a World Series that they should have taken him a little bit more seriously. Like, he never wanted he never wanted Kevin Mitchell to get traded. He never approved that. He never approved Ray Knight not getting signed. He wanted Knight back. I mean, he knew the soul of that team, and as it turned out, you know, he was certainly right about Kevin Mitchell.
Oh, yes.
Who would go on to win the MVP award 3 years later with the Giants. And I think a Kevin Mitchell, had he stayed in New York, would have had a much better career than he did. But, of course, Cashin was under the impression that Mitch was a bad influence on Strawberry and Gooden, which there was no merit to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Kevin Mitchell grew up in a gang-infested environment in San Diego, but he never touched drugs, didn't drink. You know, he was just a tough guy, and the kind of guy that, if you talk to Ron Darling, he's exactly the kind of guy you want in your corner, because there's an intimidation factor that the Mets had. They weren't just good, but they were intimidating.
Eric, there's two things that stand out to me, number one, with Davey. First, zero ejections in 1986 and 1988. Amazing. They win the division. And he's respected enough, he's under control enough to not get ejected. The other thing was the famous story about how the team coming back from Houston.
He took the bill.
Yeah, you know, and he took the bill and he ripped it up.
Yeah.
And he said, we're not paying the team for all the money we're going to make this team. And he just, when you say a player's manager, he certainly was.
He was. And both are true. you know, he blamed the wives for the airplane being, destroyed.
Well, Eric, again, we can't thank you enough for coming on the show. You know, he was obviously a great friend of yours. We're sorry for the loss of your friend, but a great book, a great guy, and again, thank you for everything you brought on for us tonight.
My pleasure. Thanks, guys.
Okay, Eric Sherman, just a great insight. Big show tonight. I wish we had another hour, but we'll be on in another 2 weeks, talk a little bit more details. But great time to be a sports fan. Rest in peace, Davey Johnson, and let's go Mets.
The views expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.